From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Budget talks resumed a short time ago at the White House. President Clinton, House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole are into their second round of talks of the day. They spent 4 hours earlier trying to bridge their differences on a 7-year balanced budget agreement. House Budget Committee Chairman John Kasich emerged from those discussions saying they'd been the most productive this year. Speaking on the Senate floor this evening, Dole said he's hoping 280,000 furloughed federal workers will be back on the job by Tuesday.
It's not fair to the federal employees. And I must say, a lot of people call me and say it's not fair to the taxpayers. If you're paying people for not working, that's not a very good idea either. And I don't suggest the federal employees want it that way, but that's precisely what's happened. So it's my hope that we can come to some resolution here very quickly.
Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle also spoke on the Senate floor, blaming Republicans in the House for the latest budget impasse.
The government remains shut because some members in the House want it shut. It's government by gimmick, and it's wrong.
Both sides say they're planning to hold another round of budget talks Sunday morning. The U.S. has suffered its first casualty in the NATO peacekeeping mission in Bosnia. Army Specialist Martin John Bagosh of Rockville, Maryland, was wounded when his vehicle triggered a powerful anti-tank mine in northern Bosnia. He was flown to a hospital in eastern Croatia. Bagosh is said to be in stable condition with foot and ankle injuries. Bagosh is said to be in a column of so-called Humvees when it set off the mine. The accident occurred in a wooded area filled with bunkers and shelled buildings. Bagosh is with the 709th Military Police Battalion. Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo has reshuffled his cabinet in what appears to be an attempt at boosting a low approval rating of his first year in office. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
The cabinet reshuffling was announced late last night and will take effect on Monday. Three members of President Zedillo's cabinet were removed in the shakeup. Two of them, the energy minister and presidential press office chief, recently were rated the two worst members of the cabinet in a poll taken among leading Mexicans. They're being replaced by longtime members of Mexico's ruling party, which has held power for 66 years, longer than any other party in the world. Zedillo also removed the woman who headed the government's general accounting office and replaced her with a party hardliner who was labor minister in the previous government of Carlos Salinas, who fled Mexico 9 months ago. Zedillo made the changes in the name of modernizing and cracking down on corruption. Fewer than a third of Mexicans recently surveyed approve of Zedillo's performance. I'm David Walma in Mexico City.
Federal election officials say they've dropped their investigation of former Illinois Congressman Mel Reynolds. This is NPR News in Washington. Israeli and Syrian peace negotiators are spending the weekend in Washington. They're coming off 3 days of talks on Maryland's eastern shore. They're taking a break until negotiations resume in Washington on Wednesday. Among the chief topics in the talks, Israeli withdrawal from the Golan Heights and related issues. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is scheduled to begin a new round of shuttle diplomacy in a couple of weeks. He'll be flying between Damascus and Jerusalem, trying to seal a peace agreement between the two Middle East countries. The Seattle Opera House is expected to be sold out New Year's Eve for the Seattle Symphony's traditional performance. Now, the only question is whether the musicians will be there. From member station KUOW, Kathleen Bowman reports.
Seattle Symphony musicians will vote Sunday on a new contract. The musicians, who've been working without a contract since September 1st, have already authorized the leadership to call a strike if the proposal is rejected. The 2-year contract offered by Symphony Management earlier this month provides for increases in wages, benefits, and royalties. But the 89 musicians say it doesn't make up for compensation they gave up during the 1991-92 season in response to the symphony's financial emergency at that time. A spokesman for the musicians says they don't want to stop playing, but the current offer leaves them and management far apart. Symphony representatives continue to announce that all concerts are moving forward as planned. That leaves the nearly 3,000 ticket holders for Sunday's concert, entitled New Year's Eve in Old Vienna, waiting for the outcome of the vote. The promised refund in the event of a strike would hardly be music to their ears. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathleen Bowman in Seattle.
The health minister of Greece has reportedly resigned. Dimitris Christinos has come under fire for the failing health of Greek Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou. Christinos has been the prime minister's personal physician since he fell ill 6 weeks ago. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
The first American soldier wounded in Bosnia. It's All Things Considered. I'm Daniel Zwerdling. Just about everyone's been worrying about landmines as NATO troops begin spreading across the Balkans. And today, a U.S. military vehicle hit one. The mine exploded and one soldier was injured. Meanwhile, though, his colleagues kept building that crucial bridge over the Sava River. It's almost finished now, and tomorrow, thousands of American troops will begin crossing it into Bosnia to get the main part of the peacekeeping mission underway. NPR's Martha Raddatz joins us on the line now from Tuzla. Martha, please give us any details you have on that landmine incident.
Well, it was in an area of northern Bosnia, Danny, a town called Bijela. It's just east of the main road between Tuzla and the Sava River, where they're building that bridge. That's the river that divides Croatia and Bosnia. The accident happened about 30 miles from Tuzla. The injured man was actually an MP, military police. He was in the lead Humvee of a four-vehicle convoy. I believe there were two soldiers per vehicle. They were on a routine reconnaissance mission going over major routes that the U.S. troops will soon move into. The mine was described to me as an anti-tank mine. The vehicle was destroyed. I assume they were driving in an armored Humvee or they probably would have been killed. The MP apparently has leg injuries. He was helicoptered to a U.S. Mobile military hospital in Županja, which is on the Croatian side of the river.
Military analysts have been saying all along that landmines pose one of the biggest threats to NATO soldiers, right? And I take it that the one that injured the American soldier today was right in the area where all the troops are going to be working and traveling.
That's exactly right, Danny. And in fact, one of the things they're looking into is whether anyone on any one of these patrols yet had driven over this road. This is right off a main road. I don't know exactly what road he's on, and they don't know exactly what road he was on yet either, or whether anyone had traveled the road. I was on a reconnaissance patrol last week with a convoy of Humvees, and we were in the same area. And this mine was apparently right in the middle of the road. It was very snowy and icy up there today. I was up there again today. And at first I thought it might be weather-related, but it apparently was not. So they're going to have to look into whether that mine was there before or whether someone planted the mine afterwards. They, of course, have been getting information from all the warring parties where the mines might be planted, but frankly, they can't remember where all the mines have been planted.
Let's move to the bridge building for a moment. You have been watching the troops building this pontoon bridge over the river, I take it. Now, I have never been good at repairing doorknobs even, so maybe that's one reason why this bridge seems to me like a huge and impressive feat. Tell us how they've been building it. What challenges have they faced?
It is an amazing feat. I'm starting to feel more like a weathercaster than a Pentagon correspondent, however, because this bridge has been so affected by the weather. I keep saying heavy rains, melting snow, but that's what's been stopping them. The idea of building this bridge is it floats across the river. It's a pontoon bridge, and they unload it into the river, and it flips out, but they have to have anchors on each side of the Sava River. The problem today was on the Bosnian side. I was up there today, and it was just too icy. I'd actually spoken to General William Nash, who heads the U.S. troops here, and he said shortly after noon today to me, we're going to complete that bridge. General George Jolwin was there as well. I think they have six stars in between them, and one of the soldiers said, we've got six stars here. We'll get it done. But they could not do it.
At one point, I heard, engineers were trying to figure out how to solve a problem, and they used a little model out of paper and string, or is that just an apocryphal sort of story?
Well, I think they use all sorts of models to do these things. I mean, they use very high-tech computer graphics. They use whatever they can to replicate the area they're actually trying to build the bridge. They didn't do such a good job with their tents, however, because they flooded out on the banks. That would seem to me 101 to move your tents to higher ground.
Oh, well.
But I think they're going to get this done tomorrow. They say they'll get it done tomorrow, though they said they'd get it done today. But it was really quite a scene there. I mean, it is a spectacular feat, as you said, and they've got Abrams tanks lined up on the Croatian side, Bradley fighting vehicles ready to come across. All the people were out on the riverbanks walking up and down. There were children sledding. And then, of course, in between all this are the tanks and helicopters flying General Nash around in between the river.
And tomorrow, we're almost out of time, Martha. Tomorrow, when and if the bridge opens, what will the scene be like? Thousands of trucks pouring across?
How does 100 sound? General, I actually asked General Nash that, and he said in the first couple of days they're only going to bring 100 vehicles across, and after that maybe a couple of hundred. I think the bridge can actually handle 200 vehicles an hour, but the road, once you get off the bridge, probably can't, and particularly after today's accident, I think they're going to be very, very careful where they take those vehicles once they get on this Bosnian side of the river.
NPR's Martha Raddatz speaking to us from Tuzla. Thanks a lot, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Danny.
And now an update on what's happening with the budget talks between President Clinton and Republican congressional leaders. They met for 4 hours today. They're planning to haggle again this evening. NPR's John Greenberg joins us now to tell us, first of all, John, what are the chances that almost 300,000 furloughed federal workers will go back to work on January 2nd?
The chances are not very good. It still seems as though the Senate Democrats have the same objections that they had yesterday, and that is that they're not ready to make some exception and put all the federal workers back to work, albeit without pay. They'll get the pay later. That'll be promised. But put them back to work because they don't like a condition that when a balanced budget agreement finally gets to them, they would be required to limit debate on that issue. They don't like that at all, and they are rejecting it.
This budget impasse has long ago made a record, right? For the longest time, federal workers have been out of their offices.
That's right. And you know, if there's any movement on this front at all, it's that the Republicans have dropped their strategy, if you will, of using the furloughed workers as a club against the Democrats to get them to negotiate on the balanced budget deal, which is, of course, what they really want.
Okay, and that's the big issue. Are they any closer to agreeing on the big budget? I mean, all day today we were getting indications that maybe they're on the verge of coming to agreement on the budget.
Yeah, well, everyone is speaking very optimistically. We don't have a deal yet. They are continuing their negotiations tonight. But let's be very clear. They are saying things that indicate that the budget negotiations are moving forward, because up until today, they were saying we're dealing with peripheral issues where we have maybe 10 issues and we're dealing with a bunch of the easy ones first and we're going to deal with the tough ones later. Well, now they're saying we're dealing with the tough ones. Certainly, the negotiations that are going on tonight will include discussions about the big three topics. Mm-hmm. That is Medicaid, Medicare, and taxes. Those are the three components that the Democrats and the Republicans have got to come to terms on if they're going to have a balanced budget agreement.
And when they have that agreement, it will be the new vision of America, right? Do you expect it this week?
I would say, well, it's probably foolish to make predictions.
Add
but
to it anyway.
I think basically, yes, there will be a deal. Most people are suggesting that there will be a deal. Tentatively, they will meet again tomorrow morning, and maybe at the conclusion of that meeting, they'll come out and say, here's the deal we've hammered out.
NPR's John Greenberg. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Danny.
Even though President Clinton and Republican leaders are still wrangling over the new budget, they have essentially agreed to make the most dramatic overhaul of the nation's federal programs in 60 years. Specifically, of course, they've agreed to make deep cuts in social welfare programs and to take broad powers away from the federal government and give them to the states. And throughout all the months of debate, a lot of analysts who follow social and political trends have asked themselves, where is all the protest? Whether you agree with the Republican proposals or not, it's hard to forget all the marches over the years on Washington and other cities demanding civil rights for blacks and then gays, or protesting the Vietnam War, or demanding tougher laws to fight poverty and pollution. And a lot of people have been wondering what's happened to those people during the budget debates. At the same time, political analysts are also wondering what's happening to the conservative coalition that's pushing the budget reforms. As the year closes, that coalition seems to be fracturing. For answers, we called historian Todd Gitlin of New York University, who's written widely about the left, and political columnist David Frum. Gitlin says the progressive movement in America self-destructed even before the budget battles for a variety of reasons.
Apathy, acquiescence, demoralization, cynicism, complacency, balkanization, and if that's not enough, professionalization of protest.
Explain a little bit, please.
Well, by professionalization, I mean that when 30 million people, I think, are counted as members of the American Association of Retired Persons, and they have a lobby, a lot of people think, well, I don't have to do anything. I've paid a lobby to do what I have to do. We have a lot of people organizing, such as the Million Man March, but we don't have people thinking of themselves as parents to organize the Million Parent March, or as workers to organize the Million Worker March to raise the minimum wage, or the parents to protest cutbacks in school loans and Head Start and so on. Demoralization, there's the assumption that the world is closed in, that we're a country without a lot of resources to spare. There's this assumption that protest is futile, or that it belongs to some different era. And a lot of the organizations on whom you would rely to be doing this sort of thing are themselves thrown back on evil days.
I mean, like the labor unions.
The unions are down to fewer than one worker in six. The churches are, despite all the numbers of people who go to church, they're not really functioning very vigorously as social organisms. A lot of people are simply assuming that a kind of fatalism.
And David Frum, you see things from a conservative perspective as a columnist for one of the leading conservative publications these days, the Weekly Standard. When your Republican colleagues began promoting the contract with America, did you expect to see more public protest from the left?
I did, and I'm frankly surprised that there hasn't been more. I think, explain it in two ways. The first is we should not exaggerate the drama of what is happening on Capitol Hill, that in fact, that while a number of programs are being trimmed, that there is no important program that is yet in any serious danger of extinction, for better or for worse.
That's certainly not the way Newt Gingrich and his colleagues portray them.
Well, there is sort of a community of interest here that both Republicans and the Democrats have of making these events look as big as possible. When you look at the numbers, most of the dramatic events begin happening 4, 5, 6 years from now. So I think that's one thing. It's hard to mobilize protesters to say there's something that you're not going to like that's going to happen two whole congressional elections away. But I think what it is also true, as Mr. Gitlin says, is that you can't just energize people to go down to Washington and say, stop this, we don't like this. They have to have some positive alternative vision. And we are at a time now where I think there is a very profound consensus that the social welfare programs that have been put in place over the past 30 years do not work very well. It's kind of embarrassing to be seen defending them. They have produced, even in the eyes of those who don't like what the Republicans are doing, a lot of perverse consequences. And it's embarrassing to go to Washington and defend the welfare system as we know it.
Todd Gitlin, do you agree with that? I mean, maybe the absence of big demonstrations really does prove that most people agree deep down inside that the Republican leaders are right. We do need to make these big changes.
You know, the present welfare programs are better than no welfare programs, but they're not so good that people want to defend them so vigorously. In other words, it's sort of a matter of, well, you know, your life may be miserable. You may have a cardboard shack. Somebody then proposes to bulldoze your shack. You may not be that excited about preserving the shack when you know it's only a shack. You know that the shack is better than the absence of a shack.
So you're saying these traditional voices of what we might call the left, the labor unions, the anti-poverty coalitions, the maybe environmental groups, that they're so demoralized because they think the existing programs are so weak that
paltry,
that they just can't get excited about anything.
Well,
that's sort of a grim view.
I think that, you know, let's face it, liberals and the left, whatever we want to call it, has for a long time been criticizing these programs. You know, it's funny to me to hear Newt Gingrich talk about the top-down programs of the 60s, which the new left advocated and so on. That's nonsense. It was the left in the 60s that was critical of these programs because they were top-down, because they were invasive, because they were top-heavy and so on. We were against bureaucracy, too. And the Republicans come along with a draconian position. Well, we think this is miserable. Let's erase it. It's sort of like saying, well, this cardboard shack is leaky. Let's tear it down. And it's very hard to get worked up about preserving something of which you're so critical yourself.
One thing that I thought Mr. Gitlin might suggest, and I actually, this is what I understand is his critique of the American left, and I think there's a lot of truth in it, is rallies and protests don't happen by themselves. They have to be led. They have to be led by people who are very active, who are very committed to politics. I think that those people would be organizing demonstrations if the Republicans were, for example, putting restrictions on the abortion right, or if the Republicans were enacting sense of the Congress legislation approving Colorado's Proposition 2.
That, of course, had to do with the rights of gays.
That's right. Or might be there, in fact, if there were some serious rollback of affirmative action. I think that what has happened is that the leaders of the American left have become so preoccupied with issues of race and sex and sexuality that vulgar issues like economics don't excite them so much anymore.
Todd Gitlin, give a prescription to your associates on the left of what they should do, what you would like to see them do to mobilize large numbers of people this year to speak out and change America the way you think they want to change it.
I think the crucial element here is the AFL-CIO, which is the one sign of life for the left. If it does organize the people it says it's going to organize, and if it then succeeds in convincing a lot of other sort of hanging back independent people on the left that there's some prospect for an economic majority which wants to increase the amount of equality and decrease the amount of poverty and inequality in the society, then we might see something interesting happen.
You know, David Frum, Todd Gitlin has just suggested something, I think between the lines of what he's saying, and that is, first of all, that the left doesn't really have any coherent vision of America, that the only coherent vision of America these days, whether you agree or disagree, is coming from the right. But on the other hand, public opinion polls are showing that most Americans, over 50% of them, say the Republicans are going too far in those proposals.
But you can believe that someone is going too fast and still say there isn't a lot of alternative. I wish this were happening more slowly. I wish there were more time to think. But I don't know that there is another way to go.
But it's even more complicated than that, don't you think, in the sense that it's not just voters who are saying that the Republican leadership is going too far in its proposals to cut the budget. Many Republican moderates in Congress have been dragging their feet saying, wait a minute, we're not going along with some of these cuts. That's not what we signed up for. You're gutting too much of the social welfare programs. So what I'm wondering is, if you agree that the left has already disintegrated, don't you also have to agree that the right is splintering into different factions that don't agree with each other about all these programs?
Well, there's some truth to that. I wouldn't take it too far, though. I mean, there is a difference between the Republicans of the House and the Republicans of the Senate. There's some difference, too, between Republicans in Congress and Republicans in the country at large. And certainly the support for Colin Powell in many quarters of the Republican Party was definitely a message of go slow. That's what Colin Powell was saying. That's what people were responding to a great extent. But let's not take our eyes off the main story, which is that this is a congressional majority that is remarkably united by the standards of previous Congresses. And I think among Republicans there is quite a lot of consensus about the direction we should travel in. Different people want to get off at different stops. Some think 59th Street will be fine, others want to go all the way downtown. But I don't think there's a lot of dissent on the right about what it is that Republicans should be trying to do over the next 6 to 9 months.
David Frum is a contributing editor for the Weekly Standard. Todd Gitlin's latest book is The Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Wracked by Culture Wars.
I'm Dave Mattingly with these headlines. The U.S. has suffered its first casualty in the NATO peacekeeping mission. Army Specialist Martin John Bagash of Rockville, Maryland, was wounded when his vehicle hit a landmine in northern Bosnia. Army engineers say they're hoping to complete a pontoon bridge over the Sava River from Croatia into Bosnia by Sunday. Bad weather has hindered completion of the key link for the 20,000 U.S. troops being deployed there. President Clinton and Republican congressional leaders are holding more budget talks this evening aimed at ending the latest government shutdown. The two sides met for 4 hours earlier today. The latest federal shutdown is in its 15th day. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.